these brave journalists who Khaleesi sees as heroes and I see as heroes. Like, we need to advocate for these type of people. We need to maybe, like, even if it's once a year, once every 6 months, we need to organize and let the world know that, you know, there's people that are willing to stand up and have a voice for a person that has a voice for us.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Hi, Tony, we can. Brother Poppins was just speaking, but yes, we can. Can you hear us?
Yeah, sure, yeah. Well, the first thing to say, I think, is the I don't know if you managed to relay it, but we've just had the news that the US Air Force is going to be flying drones out of Gloucestershire. As of literally this week, they put in an application, which obviously the British Civil Aviation Authority are going to agree to, so they can fly their drones, allegedly going over to Eastern Europe as probably to kill Russians. But the idea that these are being flown and controlled, well, most probably controlled from Ramstein or in the US or Waddington, RAF Waddington in the east of England, from the UK, it really means the Americans can do what they want with these drones. So they don't have to fly them to Eastern Europe. They can fly them to Iceland if they want. They can fly them to Norway. So if you hear of a, anywhere in Europe from now on, if you hear of a gas explosion in the middle of the night that's blown up a house, then it could easily be the American drones and their Hellfire missiles. So that is, I think, a very significant move that's been announced this week, that the Europe is now under the umbrella, if you want, it's a sort of deadly umbrella of the US drone network. And of course, they could be flying these drones from, you know, if they really wanted to go to Russia or to Ukraine, they could be flying them from somewhere in Eastern Europe. But no, they have to use the B-52, B-1 airbase in Fairford in Gloucestershire in order to do that. And by the way, when we had the Iraq war, there were some massive demonstrations. It was a fantastic sight to behold. Outside RAF Fairford, literally thousands of demonstrators against the Iraq war, because they were using Fairford as one of the stopping off places for the bombers that were bombing Iraq, the Americans. So, you know, we really need to boot these American bases out of Britain, if you ask me, like the French and De Gaulle did after World War II, or in the 1950s and 60s. There was an unequivocal move by the French to say, no, we're not allowing the Americans to base their stuff here. And these long-range bombers and the drones now flying out of Fairford. I'm just shocked, because, of course, this kind of thing which Julian Assange, if he were free, is the sort of thing he'd be reporting on, and potentially even leaking some of the sneaky European targets that the Americans might have to use these drones on.
So, Tony, I have a question for you in terms of the drones, and then I want to speak about Keir Starmer linking it back to Julian Assange. But thank you so much, firstly, for joining us. I really appreciate you being here, and we have been waiting to hear from you, so we're really pleased. These drones, okay, frigging Gloucester's not far from London, where I live. What's the kind of safety protocol? Is there any kind of assurance there in terms of, how they operate, whether or not, I don't know, like, I don't freaking want, like, military drones flying over my head. Is there anything?
No, zilch. I mean, really, all this stuff is top secret. Once they get the permission to fly them out, they can be going anywhere, and they certainly wouldn't be telling us where they're sending them. They're saying that they're going to be flying up to 60,000 feet and then setting off over to Russia. Well, I mean, you know, that's neither here nor there, really. I mean, we've no idea what the Americans, once they're launched, they're up there doing something. I mean, if you've happen to have a very good radar system, you could track and follow them. But we've got absolutely no, I mean, there are no guarantees at all. The Americans lie all the time about what their actually real intentions are. And so for me, it's very worrying. We're seeing also the introduction through this new security services bill in the UK of really putting people like you and I, people who are talking about the potential that actually maybe the war in Ukraine is not some sort of just war. People like that coming under surveillance. And then really, I think the thing that I'd really love to say about Julian is people must understand that in the Second World War, we had a surveillance system in Germany, which was implemented. I mean, it was implemented by IBM, as you know, the punch card system, the Hollerith system, which was a system of putting all those people in, on computers, basic, very basic punch card computers that IBM had organized. And this was the way in which the, for example, Jews were singled out, you know, other sorts of Slavs, other minorities were singled out for arrest by the SS and the Gestapo, etc. So this whole idea of surveillance is incredibly pernicious. Edwin Black did his book, IBM and the Holocaust, all about this. Of course, I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with Edwin and his work. And, you know, he's done a brilliant job on that. But his real message is, let's not ever let this happen again. The idea that a routine surveillance, oh, well, we're just doing it for your own safety. No, you're not. And there is every possibility that this will become an increasingly politicized database of profiles of individuals within the West, because we know that obviously that there are battles going on, you know, on different levels with the Chinese and hot war now with the Russians. And the other, the front they're really afraid of is the domestic home front. So, you know, the sort of anti-war movement, resistance, the No to NATO groups, which there's a demonstration in Whitehall in London next Sunday, I believe.
Patrick's going to be there. I spoke to him today. Really? And he told me. Chris Williamson's there.
What's happening is the secret state is now beginning to target people who speak at rallies like this. You see what I mean? So the idea that we are under this surveillance system, I think, is incredibly pernicious. Now, yeah, you mentioned Starmer. I mean, basically, it's fascist. This is a fascist system. The idea that you are part of a database, you are being profiled, even though you haven't committed any crime. I mean, in any kind of sensible, civilized democracy, what happens is anybody that wants to put somebody under surveillance has to go to a judge and get a court order, you know, get it passed by the judge, and the judge looks at it. Yes, there's a reason to put this. But what we've got now is blanket surveillance. And this is a real dangerous route to fascism. And, you know, we're getting there very fast. So Starmer, you know, the leader of the opposition at the moment in Britain, if you can call it that, of course, he's not really opposing anything. He was outed last week. I think it was on... it's on various outlets. I'm not sure if it was the Grey Zone or Declassified, one of those excellent blogs, saying that he secretly joined the Trilateral Commission. So this is the Trilateral Commission is one tier down from the Bilderbergers. So they include the Australian, you know, the sort of Asian. In fact, funnily enough, these countries are now starting to become part of NATO almost. You know, you've got a NATO delegation in Japan and places like that. And so the Trilateral Commission is a privatised form of government, really. And they are lobbying to get their people in power in these various countries. And so Starmer joined that secretly. So he's supposed to declare all of his memberships of various organisations while he was in Jeremy Corbyn's cabinet. So, you know, it's almost as if someone has gone to Starmer and said, well, look, we need somebody who's right, you know, to penetrate the shadow cabinet. And will you do the job? And he signed up to it, but he's supposed to tell his Labour Party officials, he's supposed to tell everybody on the in the cabinet that he's joined the Trilateral Commission, but he didn't do that. So he's a sneak. Yeah. So, you know, I'm sure you've all read Lord of the Rings. These are the sneaks. These are the types of people that are really just traitors to humanity. And the other thing with Starmer is he's another recent story with him is his destruction of all these records when he was Director of Public Prosecutions at the Crown Prosecution Service of during the Assange case in Sweden. He was flying backwards and forwards every week to the Department of Justice in the United States, getting his orders. Do this. And so all those records of those flights and the meetings have all been destroyed now. Under his orders, and that's now been discovered too. So you're basically dealing with a sort of Hunter Biden style character who was the chief prosecutor, actually, you know, in the UK. And this is what the mafia always does. This is what the organised crime always does. They want to control the chief prosecutor, and Starmer is totally controlled. I don't know what information they've got on him, you know, Epstein style information, but he is absolutely, I wouldn't say that they even have to blackmail him that much. He just wants to do everything they tell him to do. He'll read any script they tell him to read. And also it was revealed a couple of weeks ago that he is just basically working for Tony Blair. You know, when he did his energy speech, all the policies were released half an hour before on the Tony Blair Foundation website. So Blair is not gone, even though he's booted out of politics. He's a war criminal and he should be in jail. No, he's one of the puppet masters for Keir Starmer, the so-called British leader of the opposition, and all this sort of stuff. I interviewed the guy who's taken over from Julian, actually, a couple of weeks ago. I can't remember his name, Christian Hrannarsson, I think his name is, from Iceland, about Julian's incarceration. And he said something really interesting, which was that actually one of the reasons he thinks that the international elite got onto Julian and wanted him jailed is because the WikiLeaks had released a whole load of files during the financial crisis, which ended up getting several Icelandic bankers jailed. And they were really annoyed. They were really desperately trying to keep this information out of the public domain. It was secret contracts that had been drawn up before the Icelandic banking system collapsed that proved that that it was all deliberate. And the Icelandic government did and judicial system did jail these bankers. And that there was a message went right out around the banking system, which of course is like a religion, basically. Someone has spat in our church, namely Julian Assange, and got some bankers jailed. So we're not going to have any of this. And so that's another angle, I think, on why Julian is in jail. And I've spoken to his dad a few times, interviewed his dad a few times, and, you know, absolutely amazing, really, that he's still there. And in a way, it's a symbol of the fact that we really are going down this fascistic route, a kind of Fourth Reich. And a lot of my work has been around detailing what that Fourth Reich is, who they are. That is to say, you know, it's a Nazi organization that came out of World War II. All the Nazi loot funded this. These 750 corporations that were founded in the late 1940s and early 1950s, and then the Nazi loot was laundered through Sullivan and Cromwell's law firm in New York into these businesses. And the cheeky thing was that they put Jews in charge of many of the companies to disguise the fact that actually it was Nazi money behind the businesses. These businesses started up in the 1950s, and they were pretty much all of them were multinationals or transnationals. The idea is they're not specific to one country, that they've got parts of the business in one country and parts in another country. And, you know, they're pushing globalization. They're pushing this, you know, one world fascist system of corporate governance. And that was the secret, you know, at the end of the war, that the Nazis were sort of smirking away, really saying, well, you know, we'll be back. And they are. And they are now in this Fourth Reich financial empire, effectively, which is now trying to run the rest Western world. And given half a chance, it will start World War III, I imagine, with the Russians and the Chinese.
Thanks so much, Tony. I've just got one thing to say, and then I'm going to go to Divisive. Is when you talk about the Tony, I'm just going to mute your mic, and then you can unmute it on the bottom left. But when we talk about the Trilateral Commission, this is really important, guys. So the only person I believe from the UK who's part of the Trilateral Commission is this guy Keir Starmer, who Tony said, you know, was flying back and forth to America. Trying to stitch up and getting his orders from America in terms of what to do with Julian Assange. He is a real fascist character, and I'm really afraid for the UK because I do believe he's going to be the next Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. Now, the people, when I looked up the Trilateral Commission, the people that are there, one of the things that Tony just said is that they lobby to get their people, the Trilateral Commission, to. It's a really, really, really exclusive club, okay? And the Trilateral Commission will make sure their members become leaders of countries that they have chosen. Now, when you look at this, this is not a democracy, okay? You may think you're voting, but actually the corporations, as Tony said, the banking world, the funding, all of these things are already invested in this person. The whole establishment machine makes you think that you've chosen this person, but you haven't. They are going to place that person there, and that's the person that's going to lead the country. And the reason I know this for Keir Starmer is before he came into politics, when he was director of public prosecutions, we had Labour Party elections, and I fully believe that the majority of this country was behind Jeremy Corbyn. When those elections were going on, before Jeremy Corbyn won the election to become leader, somebody said to me, Khaleesi, it doesn't matter if Jeremy Corbyn wins this election to become Labour Party leader. He will not be the Prime Minister, the next Labour Party Prime Minister of the UK. It will be Keir Starmer. Keir Starmer will lead the Labour Party into becoming the Prime Minister, the next Prime Minister, Labour Party Prime Minister of the UK. And I said, which Keir Starmer? I only know one. He's the Director of Public Prosecutions. He's not even in politics. And the guy laughed and said, you watch. And you know what? Those words haunt me, because Jeremy Corbyn did win the elections. Then they masterminded his removal, masterminded Keir Starmer coming in, and he will win the election. The guy who told me that, he is so involved in a particular influential lobby in the UK, the same lobby that actually stifles US politics, and he always was. They funded his education right the way through, and they're still funding him to this day. So this is not by chance, this is by design. I'm going to come back to you, Tony. I think Divisive has a question for you. Go ahead, Divisive.
Thank you. I appreciate your time, Tony. And I got a quick question just because I've been trying to get some clarity on something you mentioned. There is rumors going around the internet that an AI was used in Libya to hunt down human targets, and it was being flown by an AI pilot, and it executed people without any human input. Have you ever been able to confirm that this is an event that actually happened with any of your sources? And are you concerned that the new drone facility you mentioned earlier could be completely autonomous and being flown by AI pilots?
Well, that's the aim of these systems, because they've realized that it's difficult to persuade human beings to constantly be, or even sometimes, that because people have a conscience, you know, they don't want to just be destroying weddings unless they're maybe, you know, particularly psychopathic or evil, that it's actually quite difficult to get people to do these sorts of things. We've had various drone operators blow the whistle, for example. I'm sure they have all sorts of trouble that we don't hear about with certain human beings asked to, for example, destroy a wedding party, you know, with a drone, just three or four Hellfire missiles, the whole double tap system where, you know, you get rescuers come in half an hour later, they fire another missile to kill the rescuers. And this sort of thing is much easier to program a computer to do it. And of course, this is part of this whole accelerationist philosophy. So that is to say that man should be subject. Sorry, that's the washing machine going off in the background. That man should be subject to machines, and if you look at the accelerationist, the father of accelerationism, Nick Land, and his philosophy of the Dark Enlightenment, you'll see these patterns emerging in so much of our life. For example, in the economics, the cost of living crisis, what we're seeing is, first of all, the solution, so-called, to the cost of living crisis is to increase interest rates. Up interest rates, and what's that doing? It's just making inflation worse. Same with Ukraine. You know, you've got this conflict in the Donbass. Let's coax the Russians into a fight, saying that Zelensky saying he wants to have nuclear weapons. The Ukrainian army being about to attack the Donbass in March, I believe it was, 2022, and so this really forces the Russians' hand. And then the solution to that is to pour money and weapons in, and BlackRock. This the same with COVID, you know, so you've got this exaggerated threat from the bioweapon, the Wuhan, you know, Peter Daszak's Wuhan bioweapon. And so the answer to it all is to have a vaccine, which makes things even worse. So what we're seeing here is this accelerationist policy in action, this Dark Enlightenment in action. The idea is to just create as many crises as is possible. Another one, of course, is climate. You know, we have some problems with, you go to Africa, you talk to many Africans, they'll say, well, it hasn't been raining, what the hell's going on? And there is a problem with the climate of some sort, but the solution to it is to basically reverse hundreds of years of progress and send people back to, you know, relying on windmills and maybe even water power, if you're lucky, to generate your electricity. That's sending you back hundreds of years. And so what's going on is an accelerationist Dark Enlightenment philosophy, Nietzschean philosophy, which is designed to really to allow the big corporations to grow and grow in power and strength without paying virtually no tax, and really to just call the shots. And the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral have been a very big part of all of that in the background, because they're political lobbies making sure that these corporations get their way when it comes to internal strife within political parties. You know, their people come forward. I mean, we heard about Starmer just now. There's another one, this guy, Wes Streeting. David Lammy is almost certain he was at the Bilderberg conference to be the next British Foreign Secretary. So they are, they've got their people that they're pushing into these key positions who are beholden to them. And that just means that this acceleration, dark enlightenment philosophy is pushed further and further and further. And, you know, what they're doing, obviously, is lining up with China on the social credit system with these central bank digital currencies, they're slowly but surely. And, of course, once there's a massive financial crisis, which seems to me inevitable in the next few years, and maybe that's why they want Labour to be in power, you know, the B team to be in power when it happens, is they will then bring in these central bank digital currencies. They'll bring in the social credit system in China, but they'll bring in universal basic income, so to get everybody completely reliant on the state, that the state can switch them off at the touch of a button. And so I think it's important to understand that this business with the drones is just one, you know, and the use of the drones is just one part of this dark enlightenment philosophy. So you've got to take out the human input when it comes to warfare. They've already, by the way, been using Palantir software, we know, in Ukraine. And this is a Bilderberg, you know, Alex Karp at Bilderberg's little toy. And so they've been using that to target the Russians through the Ukrainian army and obviously through NATO. And they're literally wiring up this software, the satellites, in order to select targets, Russian targets. And, of course, it doesn't take a great leap of imagination to say, well, let's just switch off the humans and let's walk away. Let's go down to the officers' mess and let the computers get on with it. Because, you know, you don't get the conscience. All you get is a report at the end of the day saying so many units destroyed, blah, blah. And this is very much the sort of philosophy I think we've got with people like Nick Land out in Shanghai, working, I guess, with the Chinese Communist Party, pushing this whole idea of, look, machines are much better at everything. Let's just let them get on with it. Smart this, smart that, everything else. And that philosophy is a fascist philosophy. And it's a way of just taking any kind of human conscious morality and input out of world affairs.
Thanks so much, Tony. Let me go to Nicholas, who's joined on the mic. Nicholas, go ahead, please.
You can skip me right now. Thanks. Sorry.
Okay, no problem. We'll be rotating mics then. Go ahead to Purple. Purple, go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you very much. I hope you can hear me all clear. I'd like to ask Tony a question. Sorry, Tony, you're getting a real grilling tonight. But Tony, you mentioned earlier in one of your statements earlier that you thought there was a possibility of World War III. Or you mentioned it in connection with USA, China, and Russia. I can't see how that would be anyone's end game. Do you know something we don't? Or, you know, was that just a blasé statement? I mean, I can't see that would be in anyone's interests.
Tony, your mic's muted.
Yeah, well, it depends. You know, if you go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, loads of people were saying, well, of course they wouldn't start World War III. And they did try. The Americans tried. Strategic Air Command tried. They were firing test rockets out, ballistic missiles, sorry, over the Bering Straits. There was one that was due to be tested, and obviously it was taken off because the crisis was on, and all those missiles were then being fitted with real nuclear warheads rather than test warheads. And one of them, they kept specially. Strategic Air Command kept it specially with no warhead in it. And they fired it on the right at the height of the crisis at the Soviet Union, knowing that it could mean a retaliatory strike. You know, so there are maniacs out there. And a lot of the... Strategic Air Command people use the basic, well, we could have a war with no more than expectable casualties. And their argument was, well, it's the missile gap. The Russians are catching up and overtaking us. Unless we have a war with them now, we're never going to be able to have a war with them and win. And so that was their strategic logic. And I think that there is that sort of philosophy around today. And also, of course, nowadays, you've got this disaster capitalism, and the massive amount of money can be made out of war. With the arms industry, number one, and number two, the people that go and clear up and rebuild afterwards. So I think there is a massive incentive for this sort of mass extermination. We already know that there's a kind of eugenics faction that wants to see the world population reduced. King Charles says that there's three times more people on planet Earth than we can than planet Earth can comfortably live with. And so I think it's entirely possible that the maniacs out there see a third world war as something which will benefit them, particularly by wiping out much of their opposition, which is their own population. I think at the top level, I think China and the United States are very close. Actually, you look at the sort of Kissinger faction and you look at the sort of technology sharing that's going on. Look at Wuhan, for example, between there. And the Russians, I think, are more of a third force after 2000 and Putin's arrival. I mean, Putin started off by being all friendly with the World Economic Forum and the G8 and all that. But in the meantime, he was building up his ability to fight the Americans and win. I don't think he ever really thought he was going to have to wage a war with the Chinese, but the Russians are clearly now in that position where they could fight a world war with the Americans and win. So, and the British know that, everyone in NATO knows that a lot of this is saber rattling. But having said that, there are some out there, I think evil people, really seriously evil people, psychopaths, who are in these. And, I had one of my colleagues, Kevin Carhill, I remember him saying recently on a radio show I was doing here in Bristol, was that actually you want to watch out because a lot of the forces are actively out there recruiting psychopaths. They want psychopaths. In fact, actually a lot of the Wagner people were people who had committed crimes and ex-prisoners and this sort of thing. We go back to World War II, Sven Hassel and his books about the penal battalions and this sort of thing that were in Second World War. But I mean, there are people out there, I think, who really hold most of humanity in utter disdain, see themselves as totally superior. And when you see the way that the world reacted to COVID, you do wonder maybe they're right. The people have been rather silly and done things which are actually totally self-destructive. And their egos, I think, are absolutely colossal. They've got more money than they could ever spend, these people, and so they use it for power. And once you get that sort of power in the hands of psychos, then anything can happen. And I think if they're looking also, I think at an end game from a third world war, which would leave at least some of them in a very strong position with the world on its knees.
My point.
Thanks, Tony. Okay, let's go to Cheryl, and then we'll come back to you, Purple. Go ahead, Cheryl. Blythe, just before you do, Cheryl, the other people who've been given the mic, please can you raise your hands if you'd like to ask a question? Otherwise, Frankie and I would be rotating mics. So, Ororto, Nick, Nicholas, and Ororto, if you'd like to ask a question, please raise your hand. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Thanks, Khaleesi. Hi, Tony. I just want to say that I've been, as a publicist, I've been dealing with the media for nearly 30 years, and you're a hero. I've just got to tell you, I've seen so many of the media that I've certainly known and become friends with over the years completely turn. It's been so disheartening. So on that note, do you see that there are indeed it appears to me you know exactly what's going on, if you know what I mean. You're completely awake to the situation we're in and who's funding it and who's running it, aka the globalists, the elites, whatever you want to call them. I'm hoping. I just need a little bit of a white pill here. If you are noticing or seeing through your colleagues, either in the UK or globally, but certainly here in the U.S., and certainly given the current administration and what we're dealing with here, are there indeed journalists that are vehemently against what they have to report on? They do not want to report on it. They know what's going on. They want to keep their livelihoods. They want to keep their jobs. They want to stay alive, whatever the case may be. And I'm sorry if that's a really stupid question, but I just, I sense it and I feel it. So I just wanted to know your thoughts on that. And also, secondly, as a journalist from the UK, I believe you're from the UK. Have you had to get like FOIA requests? Can you do that for military data or information, or are you strictly using sources? And then again, that would go back to my initial question. Do we actually do, I call them white hats, which sounds really stupid, but I do feel like there are good people actually working on our behalf. Are you getting information from people that actually do know what's going on and are giving this information, or do you have to go through the bureaucratic globalist red tape that gets you nowhere, and FOIA requests can take years? So sorry, I hope that wasn't confusing, but thank you for all you're doing.
Well, look, good questions, and the answer is to the second question first is, yeah, there are a lot of organizations out there that just simply will not communicate with people like me. In fact, they will not communicate even with the BBC here in Bristol, our mayor, who's a World Economic Forum guy. He's actually a Yale World Fellow. He's a mate with Alexei Navalny, apparently. He's just been deselected and he won't be running as an MP, apparently, here in Bristol, even though his mayor thing finishes next year because he's been voted out. The whole mayor system has been voted out, which is a kind of US thing anyway. So, I mean, it's BBC reporters. Alex Seabrook here in Bristol was told he's not allowed to go along to the mayor's monthly press conference because he asks two awkward questions, you know. So there is a whole tranche of these conspirators out there, criminals, you know, involved with organised crime, effectively, and people who are making a lot of money out of the fact that there is no proper rule of law anymore. And there's very little point in even asking them. So it's like almost ask, you know, if I asked the Bilderbergers who was there that wasn't on the list, you know, complete waste of time, really. So, yes, you know, for example, there's a nightclub here in Bristol, the Lakota. I've just done a report on them, which is about rapes going on in the club, a guy allegedly buying drugs in the club and then dying. So there's these assaults going on quite regularly. So, I put the question to the club owner, I get no reply. I put the questions to the mayor of Bristol, I get no reply. In fact, what he used to do when I had my live radio show is, and I'm inviting him on to talk, is he'd say he'd come, and then, you know, maybe 15 minutes before, I'd get a note or anything. I'd say, you know, are you coming? And then they'd say, oh, no, I'm cancelling. So there are a whole load of people who are very bad actors. It's almost like they're corporate spinners, so they will only give you any information to a journalist they think is going to report it positively. So they're sitting there really doing public relations for a corporation. They're not public servants at all, any of these people. I mean, you know, our mayor's office is operating as if it's a private company, and it will only deal with journalists it thinks are going to give it a positive spin. So but the first question in a way is more interesting, isn't it? Because I do know quite a lot of working journalists in the mainstream media here in London and in Bristol, and there are quite a lot, mostly freelancers, but some staff journalists too, who are most definitely on with us. I mean, this came out for me largely during the whole COVID pandemic, when I was contacted, and various other sceptical journalists in the journalist union were contacted by staffers who wanted to share information they had about things like, the obvious thing to begin with was people who had ideas which showed that the COVID virus wasn't as bad as we thought it was, and that the protocols being implemented by the insurance companies in the hospital were killing people, but they couldn't get it into their respective newspaper or on their radio station or whatever. So we were sharing a lot of this information in the beginning. Now, those individuals are not going to go to the line with their editor and say, look, you know, either you print this or I resign, because, you know, obvious reasons. But they do find ways through people like myself and others. Patrick, I imagine, I'm sure, has got people who do the same thing, that there are ways to get this stuff out. I mean, the ultimate person that's been doing this kind of job is Seymour Hersh. Cy Hersh has done a fantastic job in getting information out that the people at the New York Times, etc., you know, the London Times, you know, just will not put this stuff out, that the British military and the American military are behind, and the Norwegian and NATO basically are behind the blowing up of the Nord Stream pipeline. You know, so someone like Cy is getting that information out. But of course, he's not mainstream. He was mainstream. So there is a lot of journalists out there like that. It's really like chalk and cheese, though. There are some who just don't care, literally. I mean, a lot of them are youngsters who've been recruited with very little media qualifications. And, you know, maybe they're in their early 20s and they just see this as, oh, this is a great, fun, exciting job. But they don't take any of the responsibility. They've got none of the gravitas that comes with doing the job for a long time. I mean, when I was working in the mainstream, there were some like that, but most of us were pretty conscientious. And particularly the Journalist Union was a good place where these sorts of discussions would take place in the newsroom. You know, we would be talking about, well, hang on a minute. There was a story that one of the editors got me to do the other day, which was just pure commercial. It's one of his mates that runs a company, and it wasn't really a story at all. So there is that discussion there. But the idea that people are going to literally lay their jobs on the line. Well, I mean, look what happened to Tucker Carlson, for example. He pushed it and pushed it as far as he could, and he was booted out for his trouble. Because, I mean, I don't know how much you know about that, but his show was massively, massively rated. So there's loads and millions and millions of people watching it. But the advertisers were pulling away because they're not interested in so much in getting their adverts out. They're interested in the power that they've got, the messages they can send to Rupert Murdoch and Fox News about if you put this sort of stuff on, we're not going to be spending money with you. And so they try and use that power, and sometimes it's successful. And I think, you know, with Tucker, this was all to do with his the Dominion voting case. There was an out of court settlement there. We've no idea what was in there, and no one's allowed to know because of the non disclosure agreements. We're not allowed to know what was in there. But I would hazard a guess and say that part of that was that Tucker had to leave, and that the idea that Rupert Murdoch is going to face a long drawn out court case that he might lose. And may lose, half of his business because he's sticking up for Tucker Carlson. Well, that sort of thing ain't going to happen. And I think that was the way that they got Tucker out, and the reason why the Murdoch empire didn't say anything about why they got rid of him, because it was all non-disclosure agreements. So, yeah, there are journalists out there, but slowly but surely, they're being kind of character assassinated. They're getting old. A lot of the local journalists here in Bristol are retiring, and leaving the whole profession to a bunch of, well.
Thanks, Tony. We'll go to Purple, and then we go to CZAC. Go ahead, Purple.
Yeah, thanks very much. I suppose I want to go back to Tony again, but anyone can feel free to answer this one. Tony, and you're sort of...
people like Duncan Campbell at the BBC were doing some brilliant stuff. The World in Action people were doing good stuff. But Duncan did a whole series called Secret Society for the BBC in the 1980s. And I got to meet him, a hammer blow to the British establishment. And it showed that there was all sorts of fix-ups going on in the House of Commons, that it wasn't really a democracy at all. Brilliant programme. And, of course, at the end of the day, that title... rings alarm bells for the Freemasons and for other secret societies and cults that want to infiltrate governments, to steer governments. And as a result of that program and various others that were produced at the time at the BBC, which were very critical of the Thatcher government, Victor Rothschild stepped in and asked he was a Labour peer, by the way. He was still alive in the 1980s, and he was in MI5 in World War II. And after, all the way after, and he was very instrumental in getting the UN vote for the implementation of the State of Israel in the 1940s, by the way. So Victor Rothschild went to Alistair Milne, who was the BBC, Marmaduke Hussey, who was the chairman of the BBC in the late 1980s, 87, and said, can you sack the Director General? So why Victor Rothschild is the guy who starts the ball rolling to kill the BBC in the 1980s, and ever since, I mean, I've watched it. I joined in 1989, and when I was there, I could see bit by bit creepy managers coming in, a lot of nepotism, and people being given jobs because they were mates of producers, some very weird producers arriving, and a lot of the best people having to basically keep their head down to keep to keep their job. And slowly but surely, I mean, I work for a radio station called Greater London Radio. Some listeners may remember, if you're a Londoner, back in the 1980s and 90s, which was a terrific station. I mean, everyone in London was listening to it because it was great music. And we were a really good news team. We were a fantastic newsroom. And those people taught me what I know today, which is that the listener is first. The absolutely, in journalism, never compromise. I mean, and some of them did compromise, but they knew it was important that there were some people around like me that just refused to compromise and carried on and got on with the job, come what may.
Thanks, Tony. And my apologies, Purple. I thought Tony had finished at the time, but go ahead with your question now, please.
Okay, thank you very much. Tony, I suppose primarily I'm asking you this question, but anyone in the room can feel free to chat on it as well. Just in your work as a journalist and your knowledge, what actually do you think the conclusion of the war in Ukraine will be? I mean, there doesn't seem to be any, maybe I'm too naive or too vague, but there doesn't seem to be any real impasse in the world of politicians from the West and the East to sit around a table and resolve this situation. Could there not be some sort of peace agreement agreed upon, like in Northern Ireland here? You know, can there not be some sort of peace settlement in Ukraine to stop the loss of life and the loss of people leaving their homes and the destruction of the cities? Or is that not, is there no interest in that? Or, you know?
Yes, I think it is quite feasible that there will be, but I guess it's got to be the West that does that. But I mean, at the moment, I think that I look at the whole financial situation in a similar way. Is why should the elites bother? I mean, they're in a situation now where they are basically slowly but surely taking over and owning Ukraine. So why don't they just allow that to continue, to allow the Zelensky lot to get more and more in debt? Also, of course, they're able to trial all this new wonderful Palantir, you know, automatic computer warfighting technology in Ukraine and killing real Russians with it. So they're looking at Ukraine, I think, as a test zone, a bit like Northern Ireland. You know, I don't know if you're talking from Northern Ireland now, sound like you are, but that was what was going on in the Troubles. Seems to me, I actually lived over there near Enniskillen for a year. In 1995, while the Troubles were still on. And, you know, it became obvious to me that there was no real purpose to the continued fighting, that it was other than this is a great place for the British Army to do urban warfare training. It might sound cynical, but, I mean, you look, go back to how it all started with the Bloody Sunday massacre in 1972, I think it was. Well, Lord Carrington, the chairman of Bilderberg and also the Secretary General of NATO, who was involved in my book I wrote, which is The Traitors of Arnhem, and you'll see the connection with him going right the way back to the Nazis, you know, collaboration with the Nazis.
Johnny, we lost you.
Debt trap. But also, there's also the fact that it's a live fire exercise and training for a war with Russia, I said. Anyway, listen, I'm going to have to go because I've got guests here and I'm neglecting them. But it's been very kind of you to ask me on to talk about these things. And I'm happy to do this with a bit more notice another time.
Yeah.
Is that all right?
Listen, Tony, I really appreciate you joining. I know it was exceptionally short notice and you had a whole evening of events planned. So really good. I will give you a call and we'll plan this properly because I do want to hear a lot more from you about Assange. I know you were integral to his case. So thank you so much. Any comments for Tony, anybody before he leaves? Frankie, Cheryl, Ryan, anybody, Louisiana, Divisive?
Tony, you were fantastic. Thank you. Thank you so much.
No, well, thank you for actually bothering to listen, and it's lovely. I do a radio show, by the way, every week, thisweek.org.uk. You can find it. The last one is really not worth listening to because it was one where we had, due to family reasons, to cancel the live show. But the live shows, we'll be doing it again on Friday, 5 p.m. UK time for 3 hours, crunching through the week's news. And we do a bit of local news, national and international, no holds barred, and also some proper investigations. Because I think, for me, you know, I was talking about Duncan Campbell earlier, you know, these are the real The real journalism is drilling into what's really going on and digging it up. As I was talking about, you know, earlier on, you know, the dark enlightenment, the accelerationism, which is a philosophy, which is our political system in the West is in the grip of, but no one's talking about it. Well, a few people are talking about it, but one or two. And in fact, I phoned up Talk Radio a few weeks ago to say, you know, what about accelerationism and the dark enlightenment? They just, ha ha ha, how silly, this sounds like a conspiracy nutcase. It's not. It's real. It's out there. It's a philosophy, and it's governing and guiding most of our politicians in the Western world, even if they don't know why they're doing what they're doing. That's what's at the back of it, I believe. So thisweek.org.uk, if anyone's interested in tuning in, and I hope to speak to you guys again, Khaleesi. Oh, the book is The Traitors of Arnhem. If anyone wants to look at this whole, all the research I've done on the Fourth Reich, which is the multi-born during World War II, Desmond Morton. So that's the Hitler's private secretary and Churchill's private secretary doing these deals in 1944 before the end of the war. Please, I'm sure some people would enjoy that. And it's a free download if people want. Or they can buy a paperback copy for 15 quid. And that's from Bilderberg.org, www.bilderberg.org. Thanks, Khaleesi.
You're welcome, Tony. Thank you so much for joining. I hope you enjoy the rest of your evening, and I will give you a call and we'll speak soon.
Lovely.
And we'll arrange this properly. Thanks, Tony.
Okay, and God bless everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. What a lovely guy, wasn't he, guys?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that was a lot of information. That was fantastic.
He's really, really good. I hosted him on a space, might have been 2-3 months ago. Just time flies, doesn't it? Yeah, he's a wealth of knowledge, a real wealth of knowledge. So I just gave him a call today, and I it was so short notice for him, and he still came and gave time. But we'll arrange something properly with him, because he's like kind of foreign policy knowledge in terms of, you know, the things that we speak about. And if you go on some spaces, you'd be called a conspiracy theorist, and you think, oh, I'm not sure if I've got the receipts. He brings the receipts to you. So that's what's really good. And then we can make it a broader discussion just generally about how these different organizations all work with each other in terms of the corruption to hold our states together, how they give us the fake kind of notion that we have a democracy, you know. And it's quite ironic because they make us believe we've got a democracy, which we know. Well, I know I'm not living in a freaking democracy. It's what Tony said, completely 100% bang on the money. He said it's fascism, and it is fascism. If they're going to do surveillance on people just because they might be against this Russia-Ukraine conflict, and they're not even going to court, they're bypassing the legal system, that's fascism. By the way, guys, they've been doing that for a long time. It's just now they're making it acceptable to do on everybody, but they've been doing it on the Muslim community for a long time because of this fake war on terror for 20 years that's been existing. So the Muslim community have been in surveillance right the way through. And I wish Suleiman was here to talk about that a little bit more, because he's got knowledge on that. But they're now doing it on everybody, and that is fascism. So we know it's not a democracy, right? I say this on spaces sometimes, and some of you will have heard me, but the night before the Russia-Ukraine conflict, or a couple of days before, 11 members of parliament signed a statement from an organization called Stop the War. Stop the War was formed around the time of the Iraq War. And it's just a lobbying company, right? It's not a company, it's a lobbying organization. It doesn't take sides, it doesn't get political, it just doesn't want any more war. So these 11 members of parliament signed a statement saying, we don't want this war, like Russia-Ukraine conflict, you know, stop it. It didn't mention Putin. It didn't mention Zelensky. It didn't take sides. It just said, no, we don't want it. They were all threatened with the sack, that if they didn't take their signature off those statements within 24 hours. And they're our elected representatives, 11 members of parliament we've elected to add on our behalf, and they were representing their constituents by saying our constituents don't want this war. And there was 11 out of like 200 and whatever, 300 and whatever. It's not even a huge number. But they're all told if they didn't actually take the signature off that statement, they would get the whip withdrawn, which is basically suspended from parliament. And every single one of them did. Now, the minute that happened, I was like, you know, jumping up and down saying, this isn't a democracy. This is fascism. In a democracy, they would have been able to say, this is not what I want. That's what a democracy is about. And the irony is, right, not only do we not live in a democracy, but our governments have used the term democracy to go and bomb other countries and kill innocent people in those countries into their millions by claiming they're spreading democracy. Now, I would say to my government, who the hell are you to tell somebody else how they should run their country? Look at the way, look at what you're doing right here, right now in our country, to us, your citizens. We don't have any say in the direction this country is going in, and you're elected by us. Well, actually, my prime minister is not even elected by us because he just inherited it, and we're stuck with him now, I think, until for another 2 or 3 years before the next election. So, yeah.